The following podcast is intended for mature audiences only. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. I was just trying just now, I just thought of it, to remember how the opening sequence, the radio show on Groundhog Day goes every morning. It's cold out there.
Yeah.
Because it's cold out here in Northeast Alabama right now.
Yeah.
But I couldn't remember how it goes, but I do remember that part. Anyway, it's going to be like 15 degrees tonight. And this whole entire week is going to be below freezing. So folks, if you're out there listening and you don't hear your water dripping, your pipes are frozen and it's too late.
Yep. And it's going to be bad when they explode.
Yes.
Been there, done that.
Hopefully you remembered to keep the drip going.
Open those cabinets.
Yep.
Turn the water on. Mm-hmm. Don't get just a tiny little drip. Go ahead and pay that extra water bill. I know
that's
and people's that's wasteful. But
put a big bowl underneath the faucet and feed your dogs with it.
And catch the water.
That's what I'm gonna do.
Perfect. So
guys, my name is Scott Wright. I am a mediocre journalist.
I'm Kelly Turner. I'm not a doctor. Katie Givens, not a lawyer.
And I noticed, Kelly, that you're looking bright and red. You've been to the mountains, I guess.
I've been to the mountains.
A little sunshine.
A little bit yesterday. Yeah. Actually, yesterday. Hold on, I'm thinking. Friday, as we record, I don't know what day it is. Anyways, on Friday, we were in the mountains, and it was an absolutely beautiful day. And
did some walking,
I'm assuming. We went, actually drove up to Cades Cove near Gatlinburg, and actually drove through or was near a town that I'm going to reference in today's episode.
All right.
So, anyway, so was up there, not for research, but for
Well, you didn't have to tell anybody that part. You could have just said it was part of the job. Of course, then you're going to want to, oh, that reminds me, I have a check. We'll explain
thanks.
That later, but you know, you'll know what that is when you get it.
Okay, perfect. A
couple of announcements to make.
Check.
That's a sponsor check. We appreciate the Chamber of Commerce being
Thank
a sponsor.
You. I've got one too.
Excellent. So we're flush with cash. So
yeah,
if you want to write off the whole trip as a business expense, we'll vote on it after the show today.
Perfect.
But I'm telling you right now, I'm going to vote no.
Okay. Well, I just want to say a quick thank you to Shane for filling in for me last week.
Yeah, he didn't suck too bad.
He did that last minute for me, and I really appreciate it. So I think I listened, and I think he did a great job. So
yeah, he did. He talked less than usual, so it was perfect.
Yeah, because the first take we had, I had to stop him immediately.
Oh yeah, he's not even waiting for the for Katie to bring down the song before he's jumped in, and Katie was like, "Nope,
oh no,
we're doing that over."
Censored, from the get go. Mm-hmm. Huh?
Speaking of Shane, nice segue.
Yep,
coming up. On February the 14th, that is Friday, that is a Valentine's Day, they're going to do a Motown show again over at Easy Street. If you would like to get $15 tickets to that, you can go to easystreet.ticketleap.com/Motown214. And the first show was fantastic, and I'm sure this one's going to be even better. So if you like the Motown sound, get your tickets before it's too late. If you have a girlfriend or boyfriend or significant other or whatever, might be a nice little Valentine's Day date.
Could be. So, or could be just get a group of friends together.
Yeah, they'll set aside an entire table for you.
There's lots of special guests
in
this show.
Okay.
Oh, great.
So it's not just the regular group.
And one of the people who will be on stage that night is Jeannie Hatmaker, friend of the show.
Yes.
And I was sitting in a restaurant a couple of days ago on Friday, and Jeannie came in with her forensics group.
Oh, cool.
And just so you guys are reminded how much of a mediocre journalist I am, I asked her what they were doing. She said they were sitting in the courtroom for a murder case that was across the street at the courthouse that I had no idea existed.
Yes, that's a whole new level.
I know.
I think you have graduated down from mediocre. It's literally, you can throw a rock from your office and hit the courthouse.
I know.
Yeah, the...
Good Lord.
I don't know.
No, I was going to say, the case is still going on this week, so you can continue. Sorry, I had literally brain shut down. But yes, because we saw the judge at lunch on Friday, and they were saying that it was...
Judge Mobley?
Judge Bell.
Judge Bell. Okay.
Bell.
Okay. That's... I forgot what I was going to say.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe we'll do that case one day. Maybe we won't. I don't know.
Oh, I remember what I was going
to
say.
To be honest, I don't even really know what murder case it is, but I do know it is a murder case. That's all I didn't know.
I have found out in the past, you guys remember the Barbara Ann Roberts case? We discussed it here. Uh-huh. I was there for closing arguments on the day that that happened. And I found out by doing that, that I pretty much got the gist of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe I can figure out, just I'm going to reach out to the DA next week and find out when the closing arguments are scheduled. Mm-hmm. And go sit in on it.
Yeah, that should be this week, I would assume.
I would think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyway, that's all I have.
All right. Well, are we ready for today's case? Do we have any shout outs? Do we have any?
That's all I had.
Care of all our housekeeping.
Okay. Yep. All right. Well, housekeeping's over. Let's do this. We're going to be in several cities as we discuss the case today, and we actually have an Alabama tie.
All right.
For this one, but the title, if you haven't read what you clicked on, the title of today's episode is The Clemson Bikini Killer. This case was suggested to us by Stacey Higgins. So thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, Stacey.
Yeah, thank you, Stacey.
Mm-hmm, for suggesting this one. And I'm going to go ahead and tell you I wasn't prepared. For what I was jumping into.
I got you.
Because
I thought you meant still not now.
No, I'm prepared. Hopefully I'm prepared today.
Okay.
But I wasn't prepared for everything. You'll know what I mean as we get into this, which is, if you notice, we had the disclaimer at the front. I thought it was very, very necessary.
Okay.
So, okay, we're going to start in Tampa, Florida. On December the 13th, 1987, a woman named Samantha, she lived there in her one-bedroom apartment in Tampa there with her roommate, Amanda. So the girls hang out, watch television, they go to bed around 11. A few minutes after midnight, Samantha woke up to a young man kneeling by her bedside and holding a gun to her head. Think about that. Why is it even scarier that he's kneeling? He's eye level with her.
Mm-hmm. It is scarier.
Why is that scarier?
It's more personal.
Yeah.
It's in your face and there's a gun in your face.
Yeah.
Okay. So he took some telephone cord that he had cut from the phone beside her bed, handed it to her and told her to tie up her roommate. So it's a one bedroom apartment. Mm-hmm. So they're in that same bedroom and ties up Amanda, and then he has her to tie her up with her hands behind her back. Then he ties up Samantha. He takes off her clothes. He has her kneel and press her face down on the bed, and then he's going to rape her multiple times while Amanda is right there tied up. She sees the whole thing. She's the witness. After this, he robs them. He takes all the cash that they have there and one of the girls' vehicle. I don't know which one it was, but he took one of their cars and then he told them if they called the police after he left, he would kill them. And so he leaves. And they waited until they were sure he was gone. And then Amanda freed herself because Samantha later talked about she kind of loosely tied her up.
Yeah.
And so then she was able to get free and call 911. And police discover the rapist was 16-year-old.
Ugh. No.
Jerry Buck Inman. Inman was also convicted of assault, which occurred on July 10th, 1988, and was given 30 years on August 18th, 1989. Okay. That's just the beginning of our story.
Wow.
Okay. So Jerry goes to jail. He's in the custody of the Florida Department of Corrections now for 30 years.
And he's 16.
16 years old. Because it was, you know, rape.
He had a gun. As an adult.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. He kidnapped the girls. I mean, all the biggies were there other than murder.
I don't want to get ahead of us, though, but so 30 years, let's say he does every single day. He's only going to be 46. He's not going to do every single day because that's not how sentencing works. Mm-hmm. So
you're correct.
Afraid that was where we were headed with this.
Yeah, I'll walk you through everything. Okay, so February 5th, 1991, Jerry is still in jail, but he attempts to escape. While in prison, Jerry Buck Inman had multiple suicide attempts. He tried cutting his wrist, stabbing himself in the jugular, swallowing barbed wire or chain, depending on which report you read.
Right.
And then trying to starve himself to death. He struggled with multiple mental health issues.
Obviously.
While incarcerated, he was diagnosed with the following: major depressive disorder with psychotic features, bipolar disorder, dysthymia, which is basically a big fancy word for experiencing sustained depression over 2 years. Schizoid personality disorder, which is an inability to form personal relationships. People who are diagnosed with this can be described as odd, detached, cold, and isolated. Okay, there's a scale that folks in the mental health professions use. It's called the Global Assessment of Functioning Scale, or the GAF. Because, you know, people like to abbreviate things.
Love those acronyms. Like
Yeah. So, Jerry is rated several times over the course of being incarcerated at a 30. So let me explain what that means, because if you know what the GAF is and you just heard 30, you had a reaction.
Got it.
Okay. The GAF analyzes a person's overall mental health and measures the negative impact on their life based on the mental disorder. So there, you look at what they have and how is this going to impair them in their day-to-day life. The scale goes from 0 to 100. Most people are going to score around 85.
Okay.
He is rated several times around 30.
So the lower is worse.
Which means, yes, okay, this is severe impairment in a person's ability to communicate, their overall function, and judgment. That's what that means.
Would this typically be a person who would need to be almost like institutionalized?
Yes, okay. Very much so. Okay, so then on September the 1st, 2005, he's released.
So he spent how long in jail?
16 years.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so that's a little over half,
yeah. So they let him
out.
He's all the stuff I just told you, and he gets released.
And not to a mental facility.
Nope, just
out.
He's out. All right, so that was September the 1st, 2005. Let's fast forward to May 22nd, 2006. We have a woman named Jennifer who was home in Sevier County, Tennessee, near Sevierville.
That's where you passed close by,
through, right? Yep, mm-hmm, with her two-year-old daughter after her husband left early that morning for work. She woke to a man on top of her and a knife to her throat. He told her to remain calm and he would not hurt her daughter. The two-year-old is sleeping right next to her. She told him where to find the cash and the jewelry. Mm-hmm. And he made her get out of the bed, show him where all that was. And then as she's doing this, the two-year-old daughter wakes up. He ties Jennifer up and rapes her there in the bedroom while her two-year-old is crouched in the corner of the room crying.
Oh, no.
The whole time, Jennifer is trying to talk to her daughter and tell her that everything is okay throughout this time. Okay. So then he takes her to the shower and he makes her clean herself up. And then he takes their money, but he wasn't happy with how much money they had. So he takes the daughter's piggy bank.
Wow.
Okay. Then May the 23rd, 2006, the next day, a woman named Veronica lived in Rainesville, Alabama.
Oh. Right,
there's our Alabama connection.
Mm-hmm. She took her daughter to school that morning and she went to work. She came home to eat her lunch, and as she's sitting at her table eating, a man comes up behind her, holds a knife to her throat, ties her up, robs her, walks her down the hall to her bedroom. He starts to take off her clothes, and she's kind of figuring out what's about to happen, and she says, "Well, I'm on my period." Well, hey, okay, I'm getting gross, but he verifies that before he decides he's not going to rape her. Then he ties her up, puts her in the closet, and then after he leaves, she frees herself and calls for help. Investigators determined that he actually got into her house by cutting a hole in her floor. And so he was there waiting on her
underneath
when she got
the crawl space.
Mm-hmm. When she got home. So after he left Rainesville, he heads towards South Carolina. He drove around until he noticed a young woman on her first floor balcony. He waited all day until she returned home from hanging out with her friends that evening around midnight. After she went to bed, he waited until she was asleep. He attacked her in her bed, tied her up, raped her multiple times, and she fought him the entire time. So this must have ticked him off. I don't know what happened, why this was different, but he then got one of her bikini tops and wrapped it around her neck and twisted it tight until she passed out and eventually died from asphyxia due to ligature strangulation.
Oh.
It was so tight around her neck that after the autopsy, they determined that it reduced the entire circumference of her neck by almost 3 inches.
Wow.
Oh.
DNA found there at the scene linked this crime to
the same guy,
Jerry Buck Inman.
Because he probably had to leave a DNA sample after he was sentenced to prison. I don't know if DNA helped convict him that first time, because that's right about the time, 87, 88, when DNA evidence was starting to be used in prosecutions, but he probably had to leave a sample as part of his incarceration, and that was why they were able to find him. I'm guessing.
Right. Now, who was this girl in this apartment off campus there near Clemson? Her name was Tiffany Sowers, and she was a civil engineering major and a member of Kappa Kappa Gamma at Clemson University. She was an all-A student who never skipped class but still had a very active social life. Sound familiar, Katie? Over there?
You know,
sounds
weird.
Like you.
Yeah.
Okay. She was somehow able to maintain both, all of the good grades and the social life. She was very close with her family who lived in St. Louis, especially her mom. She was a devoted big sister. She talked to her little sister multiple times a day on the phone or via chats or whatever. Sure. She was the person everyone wanted to talk to when they were having trouble. She was a great friend. Her roommate, Holly, recalled her leaving post-it notes on the bathroom mirror for her that would say things like, have a great day, or put some words of encouragement or something. She was always doing that. She was very neat and tidy, and she gave gifts to her friends often. She had a great sense of humor. And Holly carries a lot of guilt with her because she moved out of the apartment just a few days before Tiffany was murdered. They were gearing up for a summer semester, and the spring semester was already over, so a lot of the students had gone home. So there was just a few left. So Tiffany was living there by herself. Normally, she did not.
Yeah. But we've already learned that that wouldn't have stopped him. An audience.
That's true.
So.
Yeah.
No, right. Tiffany was a charitable person, and she often volunteered in her community, and she'd even done outreach programs for prison inmates. She learned sign language so that she could go to this little camp and work with deaf children and teach them about butterflies. They said they wanted to learn about butterflies. And she learned sign language so that she could communicate with them. Yeah.
A very smart young lady.
Yep. Had her whole life ahead of her. She was 20 years old at the time. So she's your all-American, just sweetheart of a girl.
Sounds like it.
Minding her own business in her own apartment. And, well, all right, let me just ask you this. Should he have been released? On everything that I just told you about his
should
behavior
have been no.
While he was in prison.
Yeah. I mean, he attempted to escape.
He attempted suicide multiple times.
That ought to get
times.
You an extra 10 years, right? I mean, that and there are consequences for
and that wasn't the only
escape
time
attempts.
He attempted to escape.
I mean, he's obviously
he had multiple of those,
bat shit
too.
Crazy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I get that they reduce your sentencing, you know, when you have good behavior and you're showing that you're reformed, but yeah.
But
no.
Kelly didn't say anything about any of that.
No.
Mm-hmm. We're talking suicide attempts and starvation and escape, and how does that get your 30-year sentence cut in half.
And mental evaluations that show that he cannot be a member of society.
Right. Well, turns out a lot of people had questions like that. And in this trial, they had someone from the Florida Department of Corrections who really couldn't answer that. They bumbled through. It was a doctor.
I can imagine not.
It was a doctor who was there who saw him while he was incarcerated and really just kind of bumbled through.
Well, isn't that the parole board ultimately who dropped the ball?
I think the doc could recommend.
Okay. Okay.
You know, the Florida Department of Corrections, in my opinion, completely dropped the ball on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's gotten out,
mm-hmm.
and he's not even been out a year, and all the things I've just talked about. Yeah.
Tennessee, Alabama, South Carolina.
And that's what we know of. I mean,
that's what we know of.
Exactly. We don't know if there was unreported crimes.
Oh, and there's there definitely were, because he even admitted to others. So he's raping his way through the South,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
until it just escalated to murder.
Yeah, I mean, he drove west, southwest from Sevierville, Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
4 or 5 hours to get to Rainesville, Alabama, which mm-hmm. is in northeast Alabama, not too far from us.
Right.
And then he turned around and went east again, mm-hmm. which is Clemson's probably 5-6 hours. Mm-hmm. So he's just...
And he wasn't even in...
Plenty of places to
South
stop
Carolina
along the way.
A long time. He's literally... As he's driving through, Clemson just happens to notice her. And he waits all day until she gets back. Because she goes, you know, she's got class going on, and then she goes out with her friends and stays out late and then comes home. So he's waited there all day for her.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Jerry Buck Inman. Jerry was sexually abused by several family members from the time he was 3 years old. He and his sister both. Now, this is confirmed by his sister. And Jerry also had seizures that were probably due to physical abuse he endured growing up as well. His mother was diagnosed with schizophrenia and was pretty much unfit to raise him. Jerry had episodes as a child where he would stare off into space for several minutes at a time. He would often lose time. He wouldn't remember things that he did or things people said to him. And he began using drugs at 10 years old. And then by That's the time he crazy. Was 16, in 1987 the is first. When the very first crime happened. Yeah. And he was sentenced to 30 years.
How many times have we heard a story that sounds a lot like that when we start talking about
mm-hmm.
somebody who's committed a crime like this?
Right. The interesting thing is, and I always have to look at this because you want to look at the background of this individual and you want to see, and you're trying to figure out what went wrong. Well, we can figure out what went wrong there.
Pretty long list.
The issue is, his sister didn't do anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
She suffered the same types of abuse that he did, but didn't murder anyone.
Yeah, but how many female serial killers do we talk about on this show?
No.
Not very many. If we do, it's a woman who poisoned her husband,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, mm-hmm. it's not this. It's not pattern behavior that just keeps going and going and going.
Right.
Until you get caught. That is typically, like John Douglas from the FBI would tell us, that's a male white male loner in his 20s or 30s.
Yeah, exactly. And the similarities between all the attacks that you can hear, he ties their hands behind their back. He makes them put their face down into the bed. This is, the sister confirmed that this is the way that they were sexually abused.
Okay.
So it's almost like this ritualistic thing that he's doing because of that's what was done to him. I'm not excusing it.
Sure.
I'm just saying.
Explaining it.
This is what is going on.
Yeah.
Did he like search out all of his victims like he did?
Totally random.
Okay. I didn't know if he like would see them and
he would
think
just
that they were
be
pretty
driving.
Women to-
he didn't really say what he thought about their appearances. Mm-hmm. He just would be driving through. Yeah. And just, it's just totally random. Mm. Yeah. Okay. So after the murder, they figure out that they are looking for Jerry Buck Inman because of the DNA. So they're putting his picture all over the place. It's on CNN. They're trying to find him. And we'll talk about how they do that after a word from our sponsors.
Hey, true crime fans. It's time to start planning your 2025 summer vacation. And why not take it right here in Cherokee County, Alabama?
We have a ton of things to do here in Cherokee County. You can wet a hook in Weiss Lake, swing away at Cherokee Pines Golf Club, take in the breathtaking views at Cherokee Rock Village, hike the National Preserve at Little River Canyon, enjoy an all-day splash at Pirates Bay Water Park, and there's so much more.
The Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce and Tourism has a full list of lodgings, RV sites, kayak rentals, and campgrounds, and they're all anxious to meet your vacation needs, whatever they may be.
So come stay with us this summer from wherever you are. Plan your Northeast Alabama summer staycation by visiting Cherokee-Chamber.org.
Are you looking for a health option in Cherokee County where the staff makes you feel like family? Then look no further than Cherokee Family Healthcare.
At Cherokee Family Healthcare, they place a huge emphasis on personalized care. Call 256-266-1021 to schedule an appointment, or you can just walk right into the office at 819 West Main Street in Center. If you aren't feeling well, let them help you return to good health.
Connie Geimer and the staff at Cherokee Family Healthcare are currently accepting new patients. They accept most insurance plans. So whatever you're suffering from, if it's a cold, flu, aches and pains, you want to lose some weight or have some preventative testing, you can make an appointment today by calling Connie Geimer and the staff there at Cherokee Family Healthcare. That number is 256-266-1021 and let them get you on your way back to good health.
Katie and Kelly, let me tell you guys a quick story. Recently, I was dining at Easy Street, and I met a man who told me that he and his wife were planning to retire soon to the Weiss Lake area from out of state. I told him that the best person for him to call to help him find a home in the area is Greg Oliver. Greg is the owner and broker at Go Realty. And if you're like the man that I met who is thinking of moving here, or if you're looking for property or a home anywhere in Northeast Alabama or Northwest Georgia, you should call Greg Oliver at 256-504-3847. Greg has a full list of waterfront, residential, commercial, farm, and investment properties, and he is ready to help you find exactly what you're looking for. Greg has 25 years of experience in the real estate market, and you can see a complete list of his current properties by visiting gregoliverweisslake.com. So visit the website or call Greg at Go Realty today. The number is 256-504-3847.
Thanks to all of our sponsors, Kelly. You are in the middle of a very intriguing story.
Okay, here we go. So Jerry Buck Inman is a wanted man where we left off. And so the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department, located in Dandridge, Tennessee, gets involved and helps to apprehend Inman on June the 6th, 2006. They ended up getting him from his mother's home in Sevierville, Tennessee, basically. I mean, there was this convoluted thing where they show up to the mother's house. He's not there. They go to the sister's house. He's not there. They put one person on the mother's house, one person on the sister's house. He's pulling in, and they see him slow down like he's going to turn into his mother's home, and he speeds away. And then he turns into a church parking lot, which is less than a mile away. And the cop pulls up behind him. And the cop never has to draw his weapon. Gets him out, handcuffs him.
Another example of how disturbed this man is, because he surely has become aware of the fact that everybody's looking for him. Mm-hmm. And he goes straight home.
Mm-hmm. And then doesn't even drive a mile down the road before he pulls into a parking lot.
Yeah.
And is very cooperative. I mean, probably because it's a man, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, though, but I just know that it was a Chief Deputy Bud, I don't know how to say his last name, McCoig, M-C-C-O-I-G. McCoig?
McCoig, sure.
Maybe? Okay. Right. I'm sorry, Chief Deputy, for... Mm-hmm. butchering your name, but he did help to get him, and he cooperated with him. Then they are going to get on the phone with the South Carolina law enforcement, or SLED. Remember, we heard about SLED quite a bit during Murdoch May.
Mm-hmm.
So they contact Agent Jeffrey Kindley with SLED, and they tell him, hey, we hear you're looking for this guy. We found him. You want to head this way? So he gets another agent, and who was, both of them were working on the case there in Clemson, and they head to Tennessee. They get to Tennessee, and they want to speak with Inman, and he sits down with the two agents, and he gives them a very detailed statement talking about driving around Clemson, seeing her, waiting on her, gives a very detailed account of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't even try not to. Doesn't even, you know, try to say he didn't do anything. He just tells them. Or
the one magic word we've all talked about, lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Didn't say that either. Yeah. And so he even tells them that he threw out her wallet, driver's license, keys, and someone in a nearby neighborhood had found those things that had been tossed
right
out.
Right where he said.
And he talks about these bandanas that he was wearing during the attack and his blue jeans, and they're able to find those items in his car. He even drew them a map of Tiffany's apartment, told them how he had popped over the balcony there on the bottom floor. It was just basically the railing.
Mm-hmm.
And went in that way. He admitted to having sex with her, but denied raping her.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't go into a whole lot of detail about her death. But he just talked about everything leading up to the actual attack.
Mm-hmm.
And then
sounds
said
familiar.
They had sex.
Yeah.
Didn't then admit to rape or the murder.
Did he ever admit the rape he was convicted of the first time?
Yes. He eventually goes and talks to these agents and admits all of the crimes that I have told
okay.
you about in great detail. He tells the same story that these women tell at trial.
Okay.
Because all of this gets brought into the trial for the Clemson murder.
I didn't know if he was one of those that just cannot admit that they've raped someone, that they have to say, no, yeah, we had sex, but I didn't rape her. You know, we see that a lot. Yeah,
right.
You know, I beat her over the head, but I didn't rape her.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if he ever used the word. Well, he describes the attack, so
he may just steer clear of the word.
He may just not use the word. I don't know.
Just, you know, but, we have these.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
That
is the thing.
That's the dirty word. Like, I can slit their throat, but I did not rape them.
Correct. Correct. No one wants to go to prison as the rapist.
Yeah.
So, the whole time he's talking with them about the incident at Clemson and the rape and the murder and about Tiffany, he is asking if South Carolina has the death penalty. Mm. And the agents confirm that. And he says, quote, I killed a 20-year-old college student with everything to live for. I deserve the death penalty, end quote. So while he is in custody, he's going to, as I said, confess to all of the attacks that we talked about. The stories line up, what he's telling them and what these women come to court and tell on the stand. It all matches. And the reason we know about these additional cases is when his face shows up on CNN, that they are looking for him, these women that he's just attacked start calling their local detectives that are working on their cases and say, that's him. Mm-hmm. That's the man that was in my home. And so then they, you know, Alabama's getting on the phone with him and Tennessee's getting on the phone and everybody's working together. And so when this trial happens, the prosecution brings in these women, and the book that I read, which I reference in the notes, and I'll tell you a little bit more about the book here in a little bit, it walks you through every day of the trial. And it is basically a regurgitation of the questions and the answers. And so there was a lot of discussion from the defense of they didn't want these other women brought in.
I was going to ask about that.
The judge allowed it.
Okay.
And it was not a jury trial. It was
a bench trial.
Just the judge, because he never denied anything.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue became during sentencing. So when we get to the sentencing trial, that's what this book kind of walks you through. Because he pleads guilty. Mm-hmm. The only issue is he talks with all of these agents. He goes into all this detail. They are taking notes. They're getting all of this down. And then he won't sign it. He never signs the confession.
Mm.
And I never got a sense or an understanding of what his reluctance was.
Well, we're talking about a polluted mind anyway.
Yeah.
Maybe in his mind, it doesn't matter what I say as long as I didn't sign it.
Yeah.
You can't prove that I said it.
Yeah.
They had video running.
Well, he just kept saying, we'll just deal with that in court. We'll just do that in court. That was kind of so I don't know if there was just this lack of understanding or if he was paranoid it's very difficult to explain a lot of his.
Well, he was in prison for 16 years. He probably heard a lot of stories from his fellow inmates about mistakes that they made that got them incarcerated.
I'm sure.
And so maybe in his ridiculous, twisted mind, he thinks he's defeating the system.
And maybe so.
But his mind's screwed up anyway.
Maybe so. But then he turns around and repeatedly asks for the death penalty.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So we've already established that this man is suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
We've already established that he's tried that multiple times. And they made a point to say, you know, his suicide attempts were not necessarily what they would consider for attention or to get better treatment, you know.
Which we've heard of before.
Right. He is slicing through his wrist. He's stabbing himself in the jugular. Mm-hmm. That's the one that,
yeah,
if somebody hadn't been right there, he's swallowing either barbed wire or razor wire or a chain. I don't even know how that worked out, how they fixed that.
That had to take a minute.
Oh. And then he's trying to starve himself to death. So he's doing legitimate things to end his own life. It is very interesting, though, on the flip side of that coin, once he gets out of prison.
That's exactly where my mind just went.
He didn't have one single attempt, but multiple rapes and a murder. Mm. So that's very strange. You know, you always have that flip side that you have to discuss. Anyway, so when he's talking to them, he's repeatedly asking for the death penalty. Now, his lawyer is going to try to advocate for him and get him life in prison. And that's really against Jerry's wishes. He doesn't really want the lawyer doing this, but the lawyer goes through with this during the sentencing trial. So, all right. So the sentencing hearing was rather complicated since they were appealing to the judge, not a jury, to either give him the death penalty or life. That's what's on the table. What are we doing here? We know you're guilty. We've got DNA evidence to prove it. You have talked to multiple agents and law enforcement and given them details that only the attacker would know. So we have these other women who are calling and saying, you are the one that attacked them. And you've already told us about this too. Yeah. So what are we going to do with you? Are you going to be executed? Or are you getting life? And so, after hearing all the testimony, and there were experts and there were non-experts, the doctor from the Florida Department of Corrections.
Let's not pin expert strained on that guy.
And then there was this whole issue with a PhD level social worker who is going to get on the stand to testify for the defense, and then the prosecution jumps up and says, well, you're not licensed in South Carolina, and that comes with a penalty and even jail time. And so she shuts up and refuses to testify now for the defense. That delayed the sentencing for months, almost 7 months.
To try to give her a chance to get a license in South Carolina?
Well, no, it was the prosecution had used her before.
Got it.
So it was just a ploy to intimidate her and just get for them to get the death penalty, I guess, is ultimately
that's the prosecution's job.
Yeah. But what it did was put everything in limbo for about 7 months, because she then gets a lawyer and consults, and that lawyer says, plead the fifth.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do it. So then, finally, they bring her back in and let her know that, look, no one's going to prosecute you. We're asking. The judge is wanting to hear from her in order to make his decision. So then she walks through all the different things he went through in childhood, all the different levels of abuse. They had already called in the sister, and she had talked about all of that. And so that's where we get that in-depth look into the childhood and her saying that he's not. She doesn't feel that he truly understands what he's doing and that he possibly doesn't even remember any of the things that he's doing. Now, that's just her side. And of course, the doctor who is on the defense side. You have people on both sides.
Right.
But they truly believe that this man, again, with a gaffe of 30 multiple times, which will severely impair your judgment, is not fully aware of everything he's doing. On the flip side of that, the prosecution brings up, well, he didn't hurt the two-year-old. He said he wasn't going to hurt the two-year-old. He didn't hurt the two-year-old. So there's some level of decision-making that he does have. He didn't rape the woman who was her period.
Okay.
So there's a certain level of decision-making. You know, he's able to make certain judgments that...
I know what I'm going to do with the guy.
You know, Right.
I already know.
So there's this argument about all of that, right? Okay, so after hearing all the testimony, the judge, what do you think ruled?
Death penalty.
The judge sentenced him to die by electrocution or lethal injection.
Yeah, the judge is an elected position.
Now, Jerry was allowed to speak during this. Mm-hmm. And Jerry gets up and, of course, he apologizes to Tiffany's family and is very remorseful. And then goes on to say that he was never abused as a child, that he had no mental health issues, and asked for the death penalty again.
Okay.
Like, I guess that was his way of ensuring that he would get the death penalty. Like getting no sympathy, like don't think there's anything wrong with me.
No, and the whole time he's talking about how guilty he feels, and he's saying that he's a monster and he deserves to die, and he's so confusing.
I think I agree with Katie, though. I think it means that he at least has enough wherewithal to realize if they think I'm incompetent,
they're not going
to
give.
That's going to be my death penalty appeal right out of the box. So I've got to try, as crazy as I am, I've got to try to convince them that I'm not crazy so that won't be an argument in the, I'm sure, an automatic appeal.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if he was looking ahead to appeals or not. One of the things that the doctor and then this PhD level social worker, which if you are a PhD level social worker, you can practice as a therapist or a counselor. Okay. So I want to make that very clear at her credentialing.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what state you're licensed in. She's licensed.
Okay.
So, anyways, they are saying that he, going back to those episodes as a child when he would zone out and lose time, they keep referencing those things, and they're saying that he has this dissociation that he can do. And they even submitted some drawings that he did in prison. And when Jerry zoned out, he could draw and often would draw. When he didn't, couldn't draw a stick man.
Okay.
So they're bringing that into saying there's two sides there to him, and they're saying it's very possible for him to have developed this other person as a coping mechanism during those times of abuse.
Yeah, sure. And that's why he doesn't remember it. That's why he thinks it didn't happen, because he learned to black it out and not remember it.
Yeah. And so that particular personality, or I don't want to get into person because we know that's kind of been debunked, but that other part of him is the one that takes the abuse.
Yeah.
Well, Jerry can go away. And then what they're trying to say is now as an adult, you don't just switch that off. When you have trauma and this sort of separation of the mind there, it doesn't just go away because now you're an adult. And what they're saying is that person is the violent person, the violent side of Jerry. And he very, very well may not remember it. But then the other side of the coin is he's providing all of these details.
I don't care. He's got to go.
To us. Yeah. At the end of the day, I do not believe that Jerry Inman needs to be out and about walking around.
Certainly not.
I think he's proven that.
Yeah.
In many ways.
Several
that
times.
He is a danger to society. And we have several women who wouldn't have been raped and a woman who would still be alive and living her bright future had the Florida Department of Corrections done a better job, I think.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
So anyways, here's the epilogue of this book, and I'll give you the name and all that when I'm done. Jerry Buck Inman is currently incarcerated on death row at the Broad River Correctional Institute in Columbia, South Carolina. On April 21st, 2020, a special post-conviction relief court determined the Sixth Amendment required death sentences be imposed by a jury and not a judge, and concluded that Mr. Inman's constitutional rights had been violated. A new sentencing trial was ordered. On February 15th, 2023, the South Carolina State Supreme Court struck down the ruling, denying Mr. Inman a new sentencing trial. Due to the state's inability to obtain the drugs required for lethal injection, South Carolina has not performed an execution since 2011. Now, this book is a couple of years old, so that may have changed since 2023, 2024.
Probably not.
So just keep that in mind. In 2021, a law was passed that would allow condemned inmates to choose between the electric chair or a firing squad to carry out their death sentence. As of April 2023, no prisoners have been executed under the new guidelines. And that's how the book ends. That was the epilogue. And this book is, let me get you, Death Row Files, and it's Jerry Buck Inman, and the author is Brennan Jones. And you can find that on Kindle Unlimited. That's where I'm found right. It. It's a very short book, walks you through that sentencing trial and gives you all the information from all the different witnesses.
Now, this is South Carolina, right?
Yeah.
There were two people executed in 2024 in South Carolina. Okay. So one in September, one in November.
And did it say how they were executed? Because according to this, they were able to choose between a couple of different options.
Via lethal injection.
Lethal injection. So no one chose firing squad.
So they got that figured out.
Mm-hmm. I guess so.
You know, Alabama,
Struggled with that for a couple of years and finally ended up doing nitrogen?
Nitrogen, yeah.
Yeah.
Which people were losing their minds over, and a lot of inmates have since walked that back after we executed one individual. But the doctor who was kind of over that, or I don't know what the oversight or whatever, just said, well, it was as expected.
Yep.
I mean, when you cut oxygen off and you just breathe nitrous, that's what happens.
Yep. Yeah.
There's only ever been electrocution and lethal injection in South Carolina.
Okay. So no one is picking that firing squad.
Seems like I hope I'm never faced with that decision, obviously, but right. It seems like firing squad would be the quickest way to go.
Yeah, definitely.
Just.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm not going to think about having to make that decision anymore today.
I know.
No, I don't like it.
Yeah. And so my heart goes out to the Sowers family in the loss of their wonderful daughter, Tiffany. And of course, all of the women that we have mentioned who've gone through something terrible. I hate that this happened. I wish he hadn't been let out of prison is what I keep going back to, but it is what it is. I mean, I can't change that.
Seems like we've talked about similar circumstances before.
Yes, we have.
Let's see. He was first imprisoned in the early 90s or 89. Late 80s?
89.
So he would be out by now anyway.
Had he done his whole time.
And he would have committed more crimes.
Mm. Yeah. Do you, is there some sort of law? And I would think there would be something where if you've got a person with this level of mental health instability, I mean, to say the least, that's an understatement. How is it legal to let this person out?
That's a great question. I don't know of laws.
Sadly, for 25 years, mental health has not been a big issue in this country.
Do we think that it might, could possibly be for once? I mean, how many situations have we talked about here where mental health, I go back to our very first season in Mentone.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Was that Hayward Bissell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What the heck?
I know. You can say hell on this podcast.
I know. I've said it before. I'm just.
There should just be like if this test is so widely used and known and.
The GAF.
Yeah. And if you know that you score a certain, like that you can't be a member of.
Well, and the doctors who were on the defense were really just baffled by why he was allowed to be released, just released. And he even said before he was released that he was nervous about being released. He really didn't want to be released.
Maybe that's an excuse for the suicide attempts.
It could have been, but I also know that that's a thing because I've worked with jail programs and you have these career criminals who have been incarcerated for so long, they don't know how to be out and about. And I have had actual clients in that program who attempted to escape just so it would prolong and they wouldn't get out.
Institutionalized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very much so. So I know that's a thing. But and another thing was the victim from 1987, she did find out that he was getting released early and she tried to call and figure out, you know, what can we do?
Yeah, when's the parole hearing?
This not to happen and was told no decision's been made. So nothing you can do. Wow. So that was tough. But and again, I mean, we're not, you know, he was sentenced in the 80s, but you know, then 15, 16 years goes by and he's released. So we're not talking about, oh, well, this was something that happened in the 80s. You know, they don't do it that way anymore. This was modern
released in the
day.
2000s. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. 2006, you said.
2005.
And not even a year later is back.
Yeah.
You know.
Mistakes were made.
Definitely. So anyways, that is the case of the Clemson Bikini Killer. That's why it was called that. Because he used her top
at one time.
Yep. So thank you, Stacy Higgins, for that suggestion. And there you go.
She owns a boutique here in town. She's not a sponsor of the show,
but she could be.
Exactly. All of you out there listening, thank you so much for doing it again. We're going to keep season 5 chugging right along. If you would like to say something nice about us, you can do it on Facebook. That would be great. You can send us an email to truecrimeoneasystreet@gmail.com. You can listen to us on Apple iTunes, or we prefer Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
Leave us a 5-star review on Apple iTunes. Say something nice. Leave your name. We'll give you a shout out on a future episode of the show.
That's right.
Is it, guys? Are we done?
We're done.
Good night, everybody.